Hello, and welcome to the Jewish Heretics Podcast. This is the official podcast of the United Jewish People's Order and the Morris Winchevsky Center. We are a secular, progressive Canadian Jewish organization that's been around since the 1920s. My name is David Wall, and I am the community's cultural programmer, and I'll be your host today. For this, the fourth episode of our podcast, I had the honor of interviewing Corey Balsam, the National Coordinator of Independent Jewish Voices. IJV is a Canadian grassroots organization formed in 2008, grounded in Jewish tradition, that opposes all forms of racism and advocates for justice and peace for all in Israel-Palestine. Corey, who has headed the organization since 2017, is a proud Montrealer. He was born in Ottawa, attended university there and in Toronto, and has worked internationally for Oxfam. He lived for nearly 4 years in Palestine, where he frequently hosted young Jews following their Israeli birthright trips, helping to raise their awareness about the human cost of Israel's actions. Corey speaks French, Portuguese, Arabic, Spanish, and some Hebrew. He is experienced in organizational development and outreach to young people and students. He says, "I see Independent Jewish Voices not only as an organization of progressive Jews that support Palestinian rights, but as a space for Jews to develop an alternative Jewish community grounded in principles of true social justice." Here's my conversation with Corey Balsam. Corey Balsam, thank you for taking time out to be on the Jewish Heretics podcast. How are you today?
I'm good. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
That's great to hear. So you are the National Coordinator of Independent Jewish Voices, and how long have you had that position?
Yeah, it's now about six and a half years since summer 2017.
Wow, that's a while. And it's so funny because summer 2017, you know, in my addled mind, sounds like yesterday, but of course it's not.
Yeah, time flies. It really does.
So one of the mandates of this podcast is that we talk about sort of people's Jewish trajectory, where they came from, their Jewish origin story, and where they are now, and that development, especially in the context of what we're calling Jewish heretics, so people who are going against the grain. So can you talk about your upbringing? Did you grow up in an observant context?
Mm-hmm. I would say that I did. I think it was a kind of a fairly mainstream Jewish upbringing in Ottawa.
Right.
My dad came from Montreal, and he grew up going to Lubavitch School and, you know, quite Orthodox, sort of rejected that to some extent. But he was really big, and he sang in choirs and things like that, even as a kid. And, so he was very much attached to the music. And so continued to sing in choirs and things like that at synagogues in Ottawa. You know, his relationship to Judaism wasn't so much about faith, more about, you know, the tradition and the culture and the beauty of that. That's definitely something that I think I inherited. It's interesting. I don't think there are that many things that I inherited, you know, from my dad in terms of attitude and politics and all of that. But that's definitely something that I've inherited from him. Anyways, my mom's side, you know, grew up going to synagogue and that sort of thing. Again, not very religious, like, you know, deep faith, anything like that. But, but you know, going to synagogue and going to Hebrew school and going to Jewish camp and all of that, right? So I went to a Jewish afternoon school, Talmud Torah, and I went to, part-time, did some extra courses at a Jewish high school, and I, you know, went to some Jewish camps, and, you know, had my bar mitzvah and that sort of thing. So, you know, nothing too intense, but I was very much ingrained in the Jewish community,
right,
in Ottawa. Yeah.
So what was the attitude? I mean, I can guess, but what was the attitude in these institutions, in your home, maybe they're different, around Israel and Zionism?
Mm-hmm. So, growing up, it was never a big issue in my family. It was never something that my parents were very engaged with. My mom had gone to work on a kibbutz in, I think, 73 to help with the war effort to some extent. But that was just something people did. It wasn't something that she was too engaged on. So, yeah, neither of my parents were very ideologically involved. It was sort of just common sense and, you know, we're Jews, so we support the, you know, the Israeli team, you know, like, right. It's like it's a soccer match. I think I was really the one in my, I mean, I also, I should say, I should have had it, of course, in my Hebrew school. And, you know, we had JNF boxes in the house, and I got all that education, right. From the Jewish institutions that I grew up in. Around 9/11, I was about 16, and there were two things that happened. One is 9/11 happened, and I was sort of awoken to international politics and, you know, terrorist groups and those who hate Jews and things like that. And at about the same time, my grandfather, my dad's dad, is a Holocaust survivor. Was a Holocaust survivor. He's passed now. And he didn't basically talk about his story his whole life. He kept it in. But in his old age, me and my brother asked him if he would share his story with us, and he did. And that's something that really impacted me. So I think the combination of being very affected by my grandfather's Holocaust story and hearing about all these people that hate Jews and are wanting to attack Jews, drew me to Israel.
Right.
I think at that sort of teenage age too, I mean, as a, you know, young man, you know, seeing the strength in Israel and that kind of attitude of, like, you know, putting our fingers up, we're not going to take it, right? That sort of attitude. And so there was like kind of brief period where I was very attached to Israel, and I kind of brought my family into that to some extent. I had an Israeli flag on my wall in my room. And,
wow.
And, you know, so I'd gone to some demonstrations. I think I dragged my mom to some solidarity with Israel protests on Parliament Hill sort of thing.
Right.
So that's... that's that. I mean, things changed as you know. But that was sort of the foundation. And you know, as I grew older, I think there were various moments that led to that shift.
Before we get into your kind of awakening, I'll call it. It sounds it's so interesting because it sounds, I know that it's annoying to try and encapsulate an entire person's life in an easy narrative, but it sounds like you kind of had two revelations. You had the kind of teenage revelation with this deep attachment to Israel, and then you had another one later. But before we get to that, can you just talk about, because I do want to talk about the Jewishness aspect. Mm-hmm. In a kind of concrete way. So you had a Jewish upbringing, you went to Jewish school, you know, you had much more, for example, than I did. It sounds like a kind of traditional kind of Jewish education in a mainstream sense. Mm-hmm. How do you express your Jewishness now? Do you engage in rituals at home, for example? Do you have a kind of Jewish practice?
Right. So as I said, the kind of love of Jewish tradition and music is something I think I inherited from my dad. I really love engaging in Jewish ritual in different ways, not necessarily in a super traditional way. But I do. So, I mean, I now have two young kids, and we do Friday night Shabbos dinner. Mm. That's something that I really like doing, and we and the kids, of course, love it, and are really excited about the challah on Friday evenings. I don't go every week, and again, I'm not a person of deep faith, but I like to engage in those things. So I was just at at High Holiday Services last week, and I just really enjoy the tradition, being able to engage with something that you know my ancestors have engaged in for a very long time. Also, you know, they're my favorite synagogue jams come out at the High Holidays.
Yeah, no kidding. And,
yeah, yeah. So yeah, you know, I really like that. And then there are a few really nice spaces in Montreal that are open to heretics like me. So
gotcha.
That's nice. And you know, so you know, we do what we can. I think as the kids grow older too, I want to engage them in different Jewish practices and rituals.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm going to ask you one more perhaps silly question, but to me it's one of the most fascinating things about you. How many languages do you speak, and why? How did you get to this place of being fluent in so many languages?
You know, it's interesting. I was about 20 and unilingual. And I went to Brazil. So the other side of my life is that I practice the Afro-Brazilian art form of Capoeira Angola in particular, which is a dance, fight, game, ritual game. There's lots of ritual in there as well.
Right.
With music and things that was born from slavery in Brazil, created by Africans in Brazil, several hundred years ago.
Fascinating.
Yeah. And so I went to Brazil. So I did my first year of undergrad, and then I took a year off to spend about 6 months in Brazil. Mm-hmm. Where that was sort of my second big international trip. The first was Birthright to Israel, and that was a whole other thing. We might get back to that. Right. But when I went to Brazil, I discovered all these, like, I met a lot of Europeans who spoke multiple languages. You know, I met a bunch of Swiss people that spoke like five languages.
Yeah.
And here I was from Ottawa, like maybe a 5-minute drive from the border with Quebec. And I mean, I dropped French in grade 9, you know, and my French was very minimal. And here I was, you know, this unilingual, Canadian, and I found that really, I really objected to that within myself. And in the process, I was, you know, learning Portuguese and very immersed in a Portuguese only, environment, except for the one friend that I went with, who was kind of my interpreter. But after a little while, I decided I didn't want her, you know, I wanted to engage with people directly, not through her. And so I really forced myself to learn. And so I came back pretty well fluent in Portuguese.
Wow.
And then from there, I think that really actually helped me with French. So when I started taking courses in French, I did that Explore program where I spent, I think it was 5 weeks in Jonquière in Saguenay-Lac-Saint-Jean in Quebec, like very French-speaking area of Quebec where there isn't much English. And I think the Portuguese helped me sort of wrap my head around speaking a Latin language. And from there, I was able to speak French. Essentially, I left Jonquière being able to speak French, more or less. And, you know, other things happened. My wife, who I met in Palestine, we'll probably come back to that.
Yes.
Is from France. I ended up working for Oxfam Quebec in Montreal, a 100% French speaking environment. That really gave me a big kick on the French front. So my French now is quite good, and my Portuguese is still quite good. Arabic is from living 3.5 or so years in Palestine, mm-hmm. in the West Bank, and you know, really trying to engage, and you know, there are a lot of foreigners there that don't speak and don't get by, but I really you know, I did connect quite a bit with locals. I was teaching capoeira in Palestine and Ramallah and in refugee camps. So I engage, you know, I wanted to learn and immerse myself. So my Arabic is okay. I get by in Arabic. I wouldn't say I'm fully fluent. It's very complex and deep.
I was going to say,
I can get by quite, I can get by, you know, for a little while. And
it's certainly not a European romance language.
No. And I suppose, right. And I suppose the Hebrew that I grew up with, I had basic Hebrew that probably helped me a little bit in terms of understanding the structure and things. But I'm not someone that I'm not an expert in, you know, the grammar and all the intricacies of the languages. But I seem to be good at kind of bullshitting until I can kind of, I can sort of make it and engage and you know, and the faking accents. I think that's actually where it starts. I can fake accents. And I think that makes others engage with me more easily. And I play with that. So I don't know. I mean, I really enjoy being able to speak to people in their own languages and do my best to kind of, to kind of level the playing field in that sense. Or there's a lot that can come from being able to communicate with someone.
Well, of course,
in their language, for sure. Yeah.
I mean, this question was very personal for me. I'm just so terrible with languages. I study languages. I've studied Yiddish. But for years and years, my Yiddish is still terrible. And maybe the problem is that they're just I don't hang out with lots of Yiddish speakers. You know, there isn't a Yiddish TV channel you can practice to. But no, it's just fascinating to me. And I think it speaks to you as a person and the empathy, you know, you're a very empathetic person. And so when you go into these spaces and you want to know the local language so you can engage with people. But enough of that. I just really do find that fascinating about you. So let's go back to the trajectory, go back to your story, because it's so fascinating. What was your original direction in terms of career in school? What did you see your life turning into? Did you have a vision? And then how did you end up getting into Oxfam? How did you end up in that space?
Right. So I've never really been one, you know, I was never the kid that said that I was going to be a firefighter or, you know, anything like that. Oh, I think as a kid, I was involved in like musical theater. And, you know, I said at that point, I wanted to be, you know, some sort of actor or entertainer of some sort. But after that, I didn't really have career objectives. I was very interested in high school in politics and history and social sciences. But I ended up getting into a program at Carleton that kind of was broad. It was a Bachelor of Public Affairs and Policy Management. So it sort of allowed me not to choose a specific discipline, but it was one that was rather interdisciplinary. So I thought that would be a good option to sort of figure things out. And then in my second year, when I was in Brazil, the year off after my first year of undergrad, I went to Brazil. And another big, I think I was faced with very real poverty and police violence. I was totally blown away by the racism there against Afro-Brazilians, the thousands of people that are killed by police every year, etc. So that really got me interested in sort of social justice issues, human rights type stuff. So I could choose in second year a specialization in human rights. So I did that in that program at Carleton. Again, no really clear job objective, except that I wanted to be engaged in work that was meaningful. I didn't at this point really engage much on the Israel-Palestine question, which was difficult for me to engage in. I think, I sort of tried to avoid it and engage in other issues that were also important to me, indigenous issues and issues related to Latin America, Mexico, the Zapatistas, I should have said one of my eureka moments earlier on in high school I got a Rage Against the Machine DVD, and there was an interview with Chomsky and with Marcos from the Zapatistas, and that was like boom, leftism. And so that I think that became a factor later on, but it really sparked my interest in that early.
There could be a PhD dissertation on Rage Against the Machine's effect on a certain generation, don't you think?
100%. So I managed to get through my program in human rights at Carleton without really engaging much in Israel-Palestine. But then in my last year, I started to, you know, I found like, I didn't want to join the pro-Israel group. I didn't want to join the pro-Palestine group. I wanted to have some kind of in between, bring the sides together. I've always seen myself as that sort of that kind of person, or I had at that point, being a bit of a connector between people.
Right.
So I joined a group called One Voice, which, you know, sort of had the Israeli flag and the Palestinian flag, and was all about bringing the two sides together, or no, having both sides advocate for a two-state solution, and sort of based on kind of nationalisms, the dual nationalisms, Israeli nationalism and Palestinian nationalism.
Right.
And I thought I wasn't all that motivated by nationalism and flags. But it seemed to me that other people were, and I thought that might be something that would engage people, and that could, you know, if we could kind of envision the nationalisms like that in a way that was really pushing towards a resolution, then that would get us somewhere at least. But then in my last semester, or nearing the end of my bachelor's, there was a confluence of forces that I think really led me to take a much stronger position. With One Voice, we were organizing sort of rallies around the world, and there was a statement by the International Solidarity Movement that was criticizing One Voice's approach for really not getting to the crux of the issues and avoiding them, and really, you know, just focusing on the two sides negotiating and coming to the table with no real principles, and obviously not recognizing the massive power dynamic. You know, I mean, the PA, it's basically like a municipality. They have no power and not much leverage. So there was that. I also had a prof that really encouraged me to look into these things in more depth. I did my undergrad paper, like honors paper, looking at Israel's designation of the Gaza Strip as a hostile territory and sort of what the implications of that were for international law and for, you know, what that might be meant to bring about. And I think the reading that I did for that it opened up a lot. It just became more and more difficult to defend what Israel was doing. You know, as someone that was involved with One Voice, I was often, you know, talking to Jews. You know, I was actually working at the Jewish Community Center in the gym at this point, and I spent most of my time talking to people on their treadmills about Israel. And, you know, I would say, okay, yes, but like, look at it from this perspective, look at it from that perspective. I understand this. But then it came to a point where it's like, actually, no, there's no justification for this. There's no justification for what Israel says is about security. This was also around the time of, or shortly after, the disengagement from Gaza. You know, I thought that was a positive move, but I realized, you know, in reading that this is part of a strategy to consolidate power, or consolidate territory, you know, hold on to the West Bank, you know, the building of the wall, all of that. So you know, I think I just read too much.
Right.
And then I met a bunch of people. I met Leah, who I know has been on your show and who you work with.
Leah Tarachansky.
Leah. So Leah and I actually went to high school together.
Oh.
We didn't really know each other there, but we connected several years later at university. And I met a few others as well who really opened up the possibility for me, sort of like the identity position of being you know, an anti-Zionist Jewish person or a Jewish person that, you know, is very much, yeah, like taking that position wouldn't be abandoning my Jewishness or my abandoning my relationship to Judaism. You know, but I could, this is, you know, Zionism is about politics. It's a political ideology. And so yeah, that really just opened that up for me. And then the rest is history, I guess. I started getting involved in different groups and I took a stand at that point.
So it's interesting because I thought that your narrative was more like you went and hung out in Palestine and that's where you had your change. But it sounds like this happened before in university. You know, all your reading. So you were the pump was already primed before you ended up in where were you in Ramallah, right?
Yeah.
So can you talk about that experience and how you ended up there?
Yeah. So just sort of finish this. So I ended up finishing my bachelor's, and around the same time I got involved in a group called Not in Our Name in Ottawa,
right?
Which was one of the groups that went on to become to join IJV and become basically an IJV chapter. So that happened then, and then I wanted to, after I graduated, I decided to take the year to go back to Israel to see what I wasn't supposed to see the first time. You know, the first time I went on Birthright, where, you know, it was a very, you know, we were only shown certain things, of course.
And could we say that it's very curated?
Curated is the word that I was thinking about. Yes, very curated. And yeah, so I wanted to go back and see what I didn't see the first time. At this point, I was already part of an amazing community in Ottawa, of Jews and Palestinians and others engaged in this issue. And I basically, we had a fundraising party and I basically raised, I forget, a few thousand dollars. People were very happy to donate and, help me get there. And I spent about 5-6 months working or interning for the Alternative Information Center, which is an Israeli joint Israeli-Palestinian organization that has an office in Jerusalem and an office on the other side of the wall near Bethlehem. I think it's actually still the only joint Israeli-Palestinian organization that's very much part of the Palestinian movement. You know, supports the BDS movement and all of that. So I just took that time to do some writing. You know, I published some articles and really learning just as much as I could about what was happening there on the ground and you know, meeting people and then you know, I realized in talking to people that for amongst the Palestinians that I was talking to, at least, and amongst others, there wasn't all that much understanding of the sort of why this is all happening. You know, what is the cause of their oppression, essentially, like the whole the settlement movement and Zionism and their displacement, etc. So I prepared a presentation. The cause of it and also sort of the differences between positions around this. And so I prepared a presentation that really kind of mapped out the different tendencies within Zionism, also, you know, a bit about the history and Jewish anti-Zionism, cultural Zionism, you know, which was a movement that didn't accept the political solution. Anyways, really just mapping that out and trying to understand what it is that motivated or that motivates, continues to motivate Jews to support this project.
But I think that's very interesting because Zionism itself is not a monolithic thing. Right. It's complex and multifaceted. That's really fascinating. Anyway, sorry, go on.
And also sort of some of the Holocaust piece and sort of how all this came together, right? And I think, I did that not to excuse what was happening, but, you know, I think it's really important for people to understand what they're up against and in order to dismantle it and build a more just society. Mm-hmm. So So I actually went back after that to do my master's at OISE in Toronto, the Ontario Institute for Studies and Education, in what's now called social justice education. And I did my research on basically that, basically, you know, trying to understand what has and what continues to motivate and motivate Jews to support Israeli oppression of Palestinians, and
did
what
you,
keeps
did
them
you
in
have,
the fold.
Sorry, did you have a supportive a supportive faculty for this project?
Yeah, it was sort of, you know, that department was, at least at that time, kind of the leftist ghetto of U of T. My supervisor was Cheryl Nestle,
right,
who I continue to work with quite closely at IJV, and I work with Shireen Razak, and who's a prominent anti-racist thinker and others. So it was a very welcoming environment for this type of work. That said, I'll just mention as a footnote, after, just as I was getting my thesis started, there was another student in my, that was working with Cheryl and also Shireen, that had a similar topic, looking at March of the Living in particular, through a similar lens, looking at questions of whiteness and all of that.
Can you just for our listening audience just say what March of the Living is?
Yeah, sorry. So March of the Living is a trip where Jews are taken to the death camps in Poland,
right.
And generally, I think there might be multiple trips. I don't know at this point, but I think at least the big trip was around the three Israeli holidays in the spring, where you have Holocaust Remembrance Day, the day for, I guess, fallen soldiers and victims of terrorism, and then Israeli Independence Day. Mm-hmm. So they're taken to the death camps, and, you know, then taken to Israel to celebrate Israel as kind of redemption and our savior after this, you know,
yes,
obviously one of the, probably the low point in Jewish history.
Yes.
So it's a total, I don't know if I can say this, it's a total mind fuck, right? It's meant to really impact people on a deep, 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 and manipulate people, I would say, on a really deep emotional level. So this person, Jenny Pido, who's now, goes by Ben Pido, was attacked in the media. Their thesis was even brought up in the Ontario legislature as an example of the anti-Semitism on our campuses.
Wow.
Despite this person being Jewish and all of that. It was like, Jonathan Kay had a number of pieces about them. There was an article in the Star about it. It was like a scandal, right? And so that put a lot of pressure on me, who was sort of doing, you know, similar work.
Yeah, it
and
seems like
similar
you,
questions.
You were dodging a bullet, as they say. Why didn't you get the?
I don't know. I mean, I published mine. There were a few little blog posts written about it, but nothing really took off. It didn't really go anywhere. Mm. And my approach was different, but again, similar subject matter. So that kind of terrified me. And I think I ended up writing probably twice as much as I would have, just to make sure I had, you know, all the references covering everything, to make sure that it was just as solid as could be to be able to stand up to the public criticism. But I mean, like, just to say, that's a ton of pressure for someone doing their master's thesis. It was, you know, and we talk about the chilling effect, of doing this kind of work. I mean, a lot of people, especially if they're not Jews, they avoid it because it's just so much stress and it could potentially destroy their careers. I thought at one point about continuing academia, but I thought, you know, if I want to continue doing that type of work, you know, how am I going to get a job? Right.
Yeah.
There's so much fear around it. There's so much, there's so much that goes into making sure that, uh, that that type of discourse doesn't get out. And the Jews, like, you know, Jews that grew up like me don't end up like I am now. So, just to continue with to Oxfam. So I graduated and I ended up getting a gig with Oxfam Quebec, who was sending, and continues to do this, I think, sending Canadians to work with, to support civil society organizations in Palestine, in the occupied territories. And that was something that I think I committed to a 2-year contract.
Wow.
And I was based at Bitezet University, supporting the work of an institute called the Institute of Community and Public Health, which is sort of led by an important Palestinian thinker, Rita Jacquemin. And so that was an amazing experience working there and living in Ramallah. And I started teaching capoeira in a very politicized way, I should say. We founded a group called the Capoeira Freedom Collective, which is really drawing the connections and drawing inspiration from the struggle of Africans in Brazil against colonial rule and slavery.
Drawing an analogy or something like that?
Inspiration from that. Capoeira is actually huge in Israel, and there's capoeira all over the settlements. A lot of capoeira masters going to Israel, you know, who are the same masters that talk a lot about anti-oppression, anti-racism, which is an important kind of fundamental aspect of at least a lot of the capoeira world and tradition.
Mm.
But, you know, we saw that people weren't making those connections or were not seeing the hypocrisy. So we did work, you know, to try to engage people involved in capoeira globally in this issue and raise their consciousness. We did a tour of, you know, a capoeira tour of the West Bank. Anyway, I could talk for a whole podcast about that.
I didn't know the capoeira. I'm certainly aware of it and I've seen it, but I didn't know it was so fundamentally, it sounds like, political. And it's just fascinating.
Yeah. And there are sort of different streams within capoeira. Mm-hmm. I'm definitely part of a stream that is more sort of rooted in that tradition.
Mm.
Capoeira Angola in particular. But anyway, the capoeira, I think, your listeners would be interested in this, and you as well. I could do the accents fairly quickly.
Yeah.
I could pretend for, you know, fairly early, you know, just to be an Arabic speaker. Later on, I could have better conversations and you know, deeper conversations. But it was, you know, Palestinians are friendly to the extreme, you know, or not in a bad way. Although sometimes, you know, when people ask, you know, did you feel, you know, were you harassed by Palestinians? I think the most harassment I got from Palestinians were from people that I had to refuse, that I said, no, I'm sorry, I can't stop to drink tea.
You know, oh,
I can't
so funny.
Come in to drink tea or something like that. Right. So you know, they're very interested. They, you know, ask a lot of questions, especially of foreigners. They're on a ton, of course, there. People are afraid to go there. And, you know, so at some point it was like on a daily basis that I would be asked where I'm from. Or, you know, why I was making mistakes in Arabic, you know, hadn't I gone to school or something like that? Or, you know, they thought I was an American or Canadian Palestinian and, you know, I need to brush up on my Arabic. That happened quite a few times, but I had to, I identified at first. I was reluctant actually, to identify. Oh, funny story. My first night in the West Bank, when I went the first time, I was woken up at about 5 a.m. I was nervous going there in the first place. I was woken up at about 5 a.m. By someone outside yelling to my ears, "Kike." You know, very derogatory term for Jews. And I'm like, what what is that? What's going on? So I sort of peeked, you know, out the window, and there's a guy with a wagon, you know, selling giant bagels. It's like, okay, like I was half asleep at this point and jet lagged and all of that. And like the first thing that ran to my mind was like, do they call the bagels kikes? Like, is that a thing? Cause that's weird, and troubling. but later I learned that he was saying kike, which is basically cake, basically what they call them. It's nothing to do with kike, of course.
But anyways,
I quickly learned that it wasn't an issue that I was there as a Jew. Like really not an issue. Again, I started becoming more comfortable identifying, because people would ask me, you know, what are you? I'd say, you know, I'm an Ashkenazi Jew. Later, of course, I said it in Arabic, and that probably helped. But there was, you know, in years of being there, there was almost never hostility. There was one American Palestinian who didn't live there, who thought for sure that I worked for Mossad. But I didn't get that from Palestinians. For the most part, the Palestinians are just like unbelievably nuanced, that, you know, like even kids will know, you know, they grew up with Jews, and, you know, Jews are people of the book. And it's not Jews that they're against, you know, it's Israel, or, you know, they might say Israelis, which, you know, I tried to add some nuance sometimes, but they knew about Jews in solidarity with them. Or if they didn't, they were open to it. And they were, you know, so many people were just like, wow, like, thank you so much for being here. Like, the only Jews I've ever known, like, have wanted to kill me, essentially, throw rocks at me, you know, the settlers or the soldiers. It was either that kind of a response, or like, you know, it doesn't matter kind of thing, you know, you're welcome here. So, you know, and originally also I would be very quick to say, you know, I'm Jewish, but anti-Zionist, right? you know, just to eliminate any concern. You know, afterwards I sort of played with not saying anything. But, you know, if we had conversations, that of course I'd explain that I, you know, I'm there in support of them, and you know, in support of Palestinians, and to help how we can, and I, you know, I oppose what Israel's doing, and, you know, so that cleared anything up, any misunderstandings up quickly. And, you know, I even just to push things even further, because I mean, when I talked to Israelis, you know, I would meet in on the other side of the wall, they'd say, you know, they'd say, oh, you know, where do you live in Israel? And I'd say Ramallah. and then, you know, the reaction was generally just like, oh my God, like I could never, you know, how, like, isn't it unsafe? Like I could never go there. They would kill me, kind of thing. And, you know, in part because, you know, I love the ritual and, you know, doing Jewish holidays, but also in part just to test it and show that we can do it. And so I could report back to the Israelis that it's totally fine. We had all sorts of Jewish holidays in Ramallah with me and my friends. We had Pesach Seders, we had Hanukkah parties, you know. And like my Palestinian friends that joined were just like, wow, we've never been, you know, when there's a Jewish holiday, they're on lockdown. You know, when Jews are celebrating our freedom from slavery, you know, for Passover, the checkpoints are shut down, and Palestinians can't move.
Right? It reminds me ironically of Nittelnacht, Christmas Eve in Eastern Europe, when Jews would have to be in lockdown it's interesting.
So I mean, you know, it's just also so upsetting, but I mean, people are really happy to learn about these things, and of course, you know, doing these things, there are all sorts of ways to, of course, do liberation seders, and we did, you know, versions that really connected with, or made those connections with, Palestinian liberation. And, you know, yeah, and of course there were a few other Jews generally at all times there, you know, doing other work there and working in support of Palestinians.
This is amazing to
so
hear.
That was, yeah.
It's amazing to hear that, you know, just flying in the face of all the propaganda, you did not live in fear in Ramallah. In fact, you lived the opposite. It sounds like you people were too nice. You were welcomed. You had that's just amazing to hear.
And I'm talking not just in Ramallah. I'm talking pretty much all over. All over the West Bank in taxis, you know, whatever. Again, I mean, I wouldn't always rush to identify, these conversations happen very often. Yeah. And, you know, just in terms of the fear aspect, there was fear, absolutely, but that fear was 99% as a result of Israeli army raids and, you know, settlers throwing stones at cars and things like that. That is the fear and that is the concern. Though, of course, you know that as a foreigner, generally, you're not like you could be caught in the crossfire, but, you know, you know that it's Palestinians that they're after, not you.
Yeah. Your passport will get you out of a sticky situation.
Yeah. So you're very privileged in that context.
So I want to. So this is your experience in the West Bank. I do want to get to. We're having a wonderful conversation, and it's so amazing to hear everything you're saying. It's just totally illuminating. I did want to get to before our hour is up. I wanted to get to your impressions because I find it so complicated, and so many people I know find it very complicated and hard to digest and analyze. What's going on in Israel now with the protests? Mm-hmm. Because I look to the IJV, I look to you as a person who, and maybe I'm wrong in this particular context, but a person who's well-versed in goings-on in Israel, goings-on in different Jewish communities, right and left, having a kind of global sense of things. Is it okay if we talk about what's been going on in Israel for the last 18 months or whatever it is? Can we switch to that?
Sure. Yeah.
So the protests are around the Netanyahu government, so-called justice reform, threats to democracy in Israel. And what I find so confusing about it is what kind of position to have as a leftist, because you have, for me anyways, like the ultimate strange bedfellows thing, where it looks like there's kind of IDF generals marching alongside leftists against the Netanyahu government. And I just find that so peculiar and so difficult to understand what a kind of responsible position should be and whether these protests are really leading anywhere to any kind of liberation, whether they involve Palestinians, things like that. Can you speak to this stuff?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, so it's tricky. This all represents an opening, you know, which is exciting in many ways, of course. And whenever you see mass protests like that against the state, that's great, you know. And I think there are a lot of people being moved by this. I think we've seen a significant shift from, you know, especially liberal Zionist groups that are sort of within the Jewish community's red lines here, more or less, you know, to a more progressive position towards us. I think the big difference for me and for IJV is sort of there are a lot of groups saying, you know, vying to save Israeli democracy. I think for in the Israeli system, and when we're talking about Jewish Israeli citizens in particular, the High Court of Israel is a key component of that, you know, democracy. On the other hand, and I think where we and others in Palestinians and others in the Palestine Solidarity Movement, you know, how we're concerned, we ask the question, you know, what democracy, you know, what democracy has holds, you know, millions of people under their reign, under their control, without the right to vote. I'm talking about, you know, all the people in the West Bank and Gaza, which is still under Israel's effective control. And of course, Palestinian citizens of Israel are discriminated against in a severe manner, you know, and are very clearly second-class citizens. So, you know, and also the High Court is, you know, again, an important institution. And there have been some positive decisions over the years. But it's also the court that approved the nation state law in 2018, which enshrined, you know, Jewish supremacy, essentially, and relegating Palestinians to second class citizenship. It's also the court that approved the ethnic cleansing of the communities of Masafer Yatta in the West Bank to replace it with to replace them with an Israeli firing zone. You know, this is not like the bastion of leftism and justice principles. It's a court that has legalized apartheid in many, right, many ways. So, you know, I mean, there have been some positives for Palestinians. Like, Palestinians have been able to go to that, to seek opinions or rulings from that court to at least put off, you know, say, demolitions of villages or demolitions of houses, you know, mm-hmm, moving the wall, etc. And so that's given them some time. And sometimes, and there have been a few positive decisions, but for the most part, it hasn't been great. I see for Israelis, and this is why we see such a broad spectrum of people engaging in it. You know, you have that sort of IDF elite and status quo Benny Gantz type people, you know, who see the radical government as just being dangerous, you know, for them. And I think they, even if they essentially support roughly the status quo and the maintenance of the occupation, or the maintenance of Jewish dominance in you know, there's a spectrum there, but they advocate and support Jewish dominance in different ways over Palestinians. You know, so I can see them protesting against this because there are, it's taking things even farther. It's giving the government almost, you know, free rein, mm-hmm, to do what it wants. And, you know, there are people like, you know, LGBTQ folks and women and others who are worried about the impacts of a religious, a very conservative government and those parties on some of their liberties, especially in, like, you know, the very liberal Tel Aviv scene. And, you know, for Palestinian citizens of Israel as well, I mean, there are risks of getting rid of that and not having that that body, the judiciary, to really defend their rights. You know, especially when we're looking at the self-identified fascists like Ben-Gvir and Smotrich and others in the government.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and so then, I mean, we've been quite inspired by there's been a block calling for equality and pointing out that if we're talking about democracy, it needs to be democracy for everyone, right? And so that's been really great. But I mean, it's unfortunately been a very small minority of the protest. And in many ways, it's been frustrating to watch that, you know, the only thing that gets all these Israelis out is something that is for the most part very self-centered. And we're really, for the most part, not talking about the, you know, 6 million or so Palestinians, about 50% of the population under Israel's control, that are treated, you know, that have varying degrees of second, third, fourth class citizenship, or non-citizenship, I should say, like those in the occupied territories. Of course, because they're not Jewish and they would upset the demographic balance. You know, like they're just, I found it really frustrating. And you know, so on the one hand, I think it's an important moment to try to capture, seeing sort of mainstream Jews and even businessmen threatening, you know, to pull their businesses out, to boycott, et cetera. That's, you know, I think it opens up some possibilities of engaging in this from different angles, because I think we need to come at it from different ways. There needs to be a spectrum of engagement. But yeah, I don't know how far this will take us, and how much we can hope in terms of addressing, I think, the much more serious and fundamental issues of Israeli apartheid and ongoing yeah. brutal oppression of Palestinians.
That's kind of unfortunately where I thought things lay. So it's almost like these protests, these mass protests, are about a structure, maintaining a structure, which is the Supreme Court in Israel. You know, keeping, even though for people like us on the left, even more so you, the Supreme Court itself is not some kind of angelic left-wing force. So it's like maintaining the structure of Israeli democracy as it is now. It's almost like a let's keep the status quo going. So is there cynicism among Palestinians and leftists that you speak to on the ground in Israel? So kind of what's the point of all this?
Oh, yeah. And again, I think there are people that do see it as an opportunity to engage in. And I think both Palestinians and Israelis. But you know, broadly, it's cynicism. And even amongst Palestinians, like when there was this new fascist government, you know, a lot of people are up in arms about it. And, you know, we're seeing that sort of penetrate the political class in Canada and elsewhere because you have some of that opposition from the more mainstream Jewish institutions. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't exaggerate that too much. You know, I'm talking about groups like J-Space and New Israel Fund, definitely not groups like CIJA. Where was I going with this?
I think you were talking about how there is widespread disdain for the Netanyahu government. That's where you were going, even among Jews.
Right. Sorry. Yeah. So you know, in talking to Palestinians after the election, you know, they saw it as serious, but not much of a difference between. Yeah. You know, like how could it get worse? You know.
It reminds me of reactions to Trump, in that. Oh my God, Trump is so horrible. And yet for many people, certainly on the left, the difference, the seeds of it and the policies were already there. It's not that big a difference.
Right.
The face of it is different, but yes.
Like, how can you even imagine, like as a Palestinian living under this, how can you even imagine it worse? And under Lapid, you know, who's supposed to be some kind of progressive leftist, you know, I mean, there were hundreds of Palestinians killed. And I mean, it's terrible. And so, yes, I mean, it's more now,
yeah,
but it's the same. It's the same system.
Yeah.
Of course, with the High Court, I mean, there are risks of it being taken to a whole new level.
Right.
You know, I think the conversation around transfer of Palestinians is becoming much more open and mainstream amongst, you know, in those circles. You know, so not just confining Palestinians to smaller and smaller territories, depriving them of their rights, et cetera, et cetera. But going back to those conversations of you know, further ethnic cleansing and removing them. There are definitely people advocating for that in Israeli society now. I try to always be, I mean, you have to maintain hope.
Yes.
You know, doing this kind of work. And you know, oppressive regimes haven't lasted, you know, in history forever. I don't think this is going to last forever. I think it's becoming clearer and clearer to people the nature of it. I mean, we now have, like, a few weeks ago, a former head of Mossad, you know, came out saying that Israel's practicing apartheid. I mean, that has become very quickly a kind of mainstream notion. And, you know, I have difficulty believing that kind of the world and the human rights community, et cetera, can have that analysis. And, you know, we can go forward for years and years and years without real attention being put to stopping it. So, you know, I'm not lying down anytime soon. And I hope others don't either.
Right. Well, you know what? That strikes me as a perfect hopeful place to end. I was going to ask you what hope looks like for the independent Jewish voices and Corey Balsam, but I think you kind of just went there. I wanted to ask just one more question. I just want to ask about independent Jewish voices. Where do you see independent Jewish voices going in, say, the next 5 years? Is it do you have do you guys have a sort of collective vision for what independent Jewish voices becomes?
Mm-hmm. Good question. I think, you know, I have difficulty, and I think things change so quickly. I have difficulty thinking, you know, 6 months in advance.
Right.
So it's difficult. It's difficult. But I think, you know, I see IJV really growing in prominence. You know, we work really closely with Jewish Voice for Peace in the U.S.
Right.
And they've in many ways been a sort of source of mentorship for us, as we've, especially for me, as since I've been working at IJV and figuring out how to build it. And, you know, they're a big organization, like maybe 30 staff, and, you know, it's a big organization. And really, you know, they're able to engage, at a high level. We actually are kind of similar in ratio, based on the number of Jews compared in Canada versus the US. But I think, you know, we're going to continue to attract more people, you know, and both Jews and others who support as the situation becomes clear.
Right.
So I can see us having, I think we're getting, you know, we've made a lot of strides in terms of relationships, you know, with politicians. We've really built a lot of relationships with folks in different parties. I think there's a lot of support, you know, it's not necessarily voiced.
But
there's a lot more critical criticism than is allowed to get out there, you know, that the party whips will allow for, and the PMO allows for, like in the Liberal Party, for instance. But I think, you know, we now have, you know, mainstream human rights organizations, not just in Canada and globally, but in Israel, you know, that are sent, you know, that are, they're calling Israel an apartheid state.
Right.
You know, we are, and with the exception of UJPO in Canada, and you know, UJPO is an important partner of ours.
The United Jewish People's Order. Yes,
exactly. you know, our organizations are really the only ones that are going there. And are really challenging things, you know, head on. And I think, I mean, I speak to so many people just randomly. I just met someone in our alley in the back yesterday. And it turns out they're Jewish. You know, I said what I do and they're Jewish, and they totally get it. I mean, and just like, I keep on meeting people, Jewish people, especially young people that totally get what's going on. So I think, you know, our role is to really sort of organize those people, and, you know, demand change from Jewish institutions here and the way in which Canada deals with Israel.
It's funny. The image of meeting someone in a back alley is just so perfect because we there's the secretive nature of it.
Right. Well, in Montreal, you know, the ruelles are very active and places where, you know, kids play and we do, you know, we go for beers after work, and it's a very lively community space. So a dingy black back alley.
If people want to engage with IJV, ijvcanada.org, yeah?
Yes.
And do you accept volunteers?
Of course.
No, of course. We're, you do.
A membership-based organization. Right. We have a few staff, but it's really membership, member-driven. We have chapters basically all of the major cities across the country, on a number of campuses as well. If there isn't a chapter where you are, you can always create one. You know, we're open to expanding in that sense and having, you know, those grassroots bases and communities at the local level, which are really important. And of course, people can engage at the national level too. So
we encourage everyone to go to ijv.org. There's all sorts of incredible resources on there, information and opportunities to volunteer. Corey, this has been a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much. Do you have anything to add?
No, my pleasure.
Okay.
I feel like it's another, you know, it's a badge of honor to be considered a Jewish heretic.
Oh, good. Thank you. Yes. Yes. You're an honorary member of the club. Absolutely. You're up there in the pantheon.
Wonderful. Thanks so much, okay. David.
Thanks, Corey. Well, we've come to the end of our show. We'd like to thank you for listening, and we'd like to thank everyone who made our podcast possible, including United Jewish People's Order Executive Director Serena Sarin and our guest, Corey Balsam. This podcast was recorded at Walt Whitman Studios in Toronto. The theme music was composed by Serena Sarin with help from me. My name's David Wall. Until next time, seid gesund.